listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
Globally, each year, more than 6 million children die before their fifth birthday. The majority of these children are born into poverty. Anita Zaidi is an internationally recognized pediatrician and director of the Enteric and Diarrheal Diseases Program at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. In a recent Conversation in Global Health seminar, I sat down with Zaidi to discuss the issues impacting maternal and child health and her work in her home country of Pakistan. Pakistan has the third highest infant mortality rates in the world. In 2013, Zaidi became the inaugural recipient of the $1 million Kaplow Children's Prize, which she used to save children's lives in the impoverished fishing village on the outskirts of Karachi. Prior to joining the Gates Foundation, Zaidi was a professor and chair, Department of Pediatrics and Child Health, at the Aga Khan University in Karachi, where she obtained her medical degree. Her research is focused on vaccine-preventable illnesses and newborn infections in research-limited settings, and she has published extensively in these areas. Anita Zaidi, thank you for joining me here tonight.
Help us understand the issues specifically to Pakistan. Pakistan ranks third in the world of infant mortality at this particular point. Over 400,000 infants die each year under the age of five. Can you help us understand the depths of the health issues there, and why is infant mortality so high?
Before I talk about this, I mean, I have to say that I'm a relentless optimist, so I have to always look at things from a glass half full perspective. People think that, for example, there's been no progress in Pakistan in child mortality, but that's not true. There has been progress. It just hasn't been as great as in the rest of the region. Compared to India or Bangladesh at the time of when it was East Pakistan had horrendous child health indicators, and now they're much better than ours. Pakistan is remarkable in that for its per capita income, it has the worst child health and social indicators. And there's several reasons for this, but the most important one is the poor status of maternal health. So, for example, 20% of the women in the low-income settlements of Karachi will have a hemoglobin less than 7. So even if you're offering good newborn services, you're not addressing that problem. And so we have a disproportionate amount of children that die very early on in life. And there are many other indicators to show that women are very marginalized, which affects their health and then affects the child mortality. For example, in our financial services of the poor program, which is in big countries, Indonesia and Nigeria, Pakistan, Ethiopia, Pakistan has the most polarization among men and women in cell phone use. Mm-hmm. So unless we address those kinds of issues, this is a tough problem to take care of.
What about the political instability? What impact does that have? You talked about the changes in the area, the progress that's been in the area. Pakistan has had significant political instability. How much does that
So what's happened is that in the last 10 years, the progress in child mortality has stagnated. That trajectory, if you draw a linear line, that sort of trajectory has not happened, which has happened in the neighboring countries. And so, for example, Sindh, where I'm from, neonatal mortality has not declined in the last 10 years. It's where it was. And so we have this missed decade of progress. So compared to 1990, we are, we are about 30% lower. But if you start from 2000, what should have happened between 2000 and now hasn't been as what one could have achieved.
You know, you said you're an optimist, so I wondered if you can be optimistic in saying, in an interview I read of yours in 2010, you said you were surprised at how much malnutrition there was in Pakistan, and that it was acute. It was not acute, it was chronic. Yeah. And has that changed at all? Has there been progress in that regard?
No, there hasn't. I mean, it's one of those other indicators that's remained. So this is what we call stunting. Stunting is when So as opposed to severe malnutrition, which is an acute caloric deprivation, stunting is chronic caloric deprivation. But it is also associated with, so that's not the only cause. We think that what is happening is actually there's a mixture of poor caloric intake, micronutrient deficiencies, and a very unhygienic environment. So there's a lot of enteropathogen exposure early on. Actually, there's a study that the foundation funded, of which Pakistan was one of the sites, which shows that enteropathogen exposure correlates strongly with poor growth, even asymptomatic enteropathogen exposure. So stunting in Pakistan is about 30-35%. That's remained static in both Pakistan and India. There are other countries that have made huge progress in stunting. Brazil is one example, and people think it's because of their family health program, which Sri Lanka is another country that's made progress in stunting. So our team right now at the Gates Foundation, the enteric and diarrheal diseases, the enteric part of the team is trying to see, are there ways in which we can make the child more resilient to the effects of the environment, assuming that they can be fed, so that through making their, promoting a healthy gut environment by either prebiotics or probiotics or other types of foods that can affect the gut and make it more resilient to bad stuff in the environment. Mm-hmm. So there's a biology part to this as well. It's not just a caloric issue, but it definitely is related to poverty.
I want to go back to something that you mentioned, which was the status of women and gender. Mm-hmm. And you said the disproportionate numbers of men who have cell phones and mm-hmm. women who die on cell phones and technology. Yeah. Sure. What are you optimistic about in terms of gender that you see? You've had women prime ministers. We've yet to have a women leader in this country.
Right. You have Malala Yousafzai. <Right. laughs> There's also recently another woman who received a Global Citizen Award called Olam Fatma, whose work was popularized through this Humans of New York guy, Brand Stanton, I think the last name is, who has been working with the bonded laborers and trying to get them out of poverty. So yes, so there are many strong women in Pakistan.
What does it take to lift a nation up when it's struggling with fundamental issues of gender and class?
So I think that all of the citizens of Pakistan have a very big role to play. And I think I'm very encouraged by the Sustainable Development Goals, because if you look at the goals are beyond just health goals. They're definitely targeting human rights and the rights issues. And I think that enough people working on these areas and highlighting the gender issues in Pakistan, you will see a difference. I mean, you can make a difference.
At the end of 2013, you won the Kaplow Children's Prize and were given $1 million, and you took that money and used it to focus on reducing infant mortality. And I don't know if I'll say this right,
Ready Goat,
in a impoverished suburb of mm-hmm. Karachi. Mm-hmm. And tell us about why that region, what's mm-hmm. specific to that area, and what were the challenges there that you met, and what were the goals?
Okay, so this is a very interesting history. So when I went back from the U.S. to Pakistan in 2000, and I was looking for areas, very impoverished areas, that I could test some of my ideas in. And this one stuck out because it was very arid. The local community of fishermen were losing their livelihoods through overfishing. And so there was definitely an environmental component to this. And newborn health indicators were very poor, actually. So newborn mortality at that time in Ready Goat was like 70 per 1,000 live births. So like 7% of babies were dying in the first month of life. And we did a study there called the Young Infant Clinical Science Study, which was an attempt to see if where places did not have physicians, could you use paramedics to diagnose serious problems in the babies. And this is sort of a paradigm shift, because until then, newborn health had not been recognized as a global health problem, right? So this was just sort of beginnings of that movement of that newborn health is a global health problem, and that we won't see the gains in child mortality unless we specifically address newborn health. Then that project led to other work. One of the main learnings from that project was that sepsis was a very common cause of death. And what was shocking to me was that even when we were making free transport and free care available to the families, 90% of the families from Ready Good refused to go to the hospital. They wouldn't take their newborn to the hospital. And their reasons were all very rational. They would say that, you know, the care in the hospitals was very poor. They didn't speak the language of the folks who were in the hospital. There was no place for the father to stay or the other relative that went with the mother. So they would be kept in a very unhygienic place for like 10 to 14 days, which is what the treatment course of a newborn sepsis infection was. So that led to this whole idea about what are problems of newborns that you can manage in communities. We did a trial again. And there were 5 sites in Karachi. And at the end of that study, which showed that you could manage newborn sepsis at home with the simplified regimens, I realized that compared to the 4 other sites that I was working in, Ready Goat still maintained a child mortality, a newborn mortality rate of 55 and a child mortality rate of 105, whereas in the other places it had fallen to 70, 75 from 100. So there was something about this community that was just, you know, not the regular stuff in primary health care and surveillance was not making a difference.
What was that? What did you find?
We realized was that through our research programs, we were not addressing the problems of this community. And so when this prize was announced, this was the sort of what the person who was giving this prize wanted was, can you design a program that's based on evidence that would save the most lives? And so what I thought about was, you know, I know that there's a serious malnutrition problem. I know that there is no antenatal care. I know that there's no skilled delivery happening. I know that the children are not being immunized. So there is a software program called LIST, Live Save Tool, where you can put in various things and you can see how much impact you would get. So we looked at, okay, what could we do in this community that would have the most impact? And we made a package of that, and that package is then being implemented in this community. And now we're like a year and a half into this, and the idea was to actually decrease mortality from 106 down to 35 in 3 years. So very ambitious. we're already at 74 after 18 months.
What is the process of regrouping? You know, when you face these hurdles, mm-hmm. when you're working in a community mm-hmm. like that, and you face and you come up against a wall, right. How do you sort of go through the regrouping?
So that's the great thing about this, because this iterative rapid learning cycle was built into the program. So like every quarter we review, okay, what are the barriers? And what I've learned from this is actually huge. So one of the things we realized is that not everybody living in a poor income area is actually the same. So there are a subpopulation of very ultra poor, less than $1 a dose people where mortality is concentrated. So when we started dividing up, Ready Goat has 42,000 people. So when we start dividing it up into smaller areas, there were actually areas in Ready Goat that had a child mortality of 300 to 400 per 1,000 live births. Like 30 to 40% of their kids were dying. and so then we start looking closely, like what's happening. There's no source of income. There are, you know, more than 10 kids. You can go to there is nothing to eat. And so they need, just having primary healthcare services and skilled delivery, it's very hard to make a difference. So even if their newborn isn't dying, the child dies at 2 months or 3 months of age because there's nothing to eat. So you realize that there is this subpopulation of extremely high-risk individuals who need more than just primary healthcare. I mean, it's necessary but not sufficient, and they actually need some sort of poverty alleviation types of interventions, food subsidies, to get them out of that. And I've been very much reading up on, you know, so there's a big literature building up now on graduating people out of poverty, out of all the JPAL kind of work, which is just fascinating. And some of their work actually has been done in Pakistan, which shows, you know, livestock training and management with some subsidies so that they don't eat up their asset in the first year. It has a, you know, highly statistically significant for getting people out of poverty. So one of the conversations that I've been having at the foundation, and Gary will be maybe surprised to hear this, is that, you know, can we do demo projects that are multi-sectoral? So for example, with the FSP, how do we know how FSP impacts? This is Financial Services of the Poor, which is a digital financing services. How do we show that that has health impact? Because that kind of health impact thinking isn't built into those programs. For example, from the JPAL poverty graduation program, what if you added family planning to that? Because, I mean, that might increase your effect size because there wouldn't be another mouth to feed if the family accepted family planning. And so my work in Ready Goat, with working with these extremely vulnerable, what I call the is that they're actually very accepting of family planning. They just need the services provided at home. They don't have the money to get family planning services. So, I mean, I've been thinking, like, could you have, through this FSP kind of programs, could you have, like, a family planning wallet where they can actually have some money in their bank and go and get family planning services like that? And so thinking through those for this very high risk, and you know, now with the SDGs, we have to get down child mortality from 6 million to 3 million. That's going to be very hard. It's not going to be as easy as getting it from 12 million to 6 million, because now the mortality is concentrated in this type of population.
What happens to the heart and soul of a community when children, infant mortality rates are so high? What happens to women, and what happens to the nature of family, and really what's the core of being a human being when death is so...
So death is people find this very hard to understand, but death is like an everyday part of life. If you're saying that there are areas in Ready Goat that have under 5 mortality of 30%, they have sort of imbibed that helplessness as like nothing, and that's the difference between sort of the aspirational class and this abject poor class, where they don't think that they can get out of that trap. That the and I mean, I've had hundreds of conversations in these communities where that really comes out as, you know, why did we were there and we were providing free care and we could have hydrated your child and your child died of diarrhea. Why didn't you bring the child? And it's because they don't think that their child will survive. And it's almost. I mean, we were having this interesting discussion on Rinderpest. You know, so this is related to this comment that I'm making. So Rinderpest is a measles-like disease that animals get, that cattle get, and it's 90% fatal. And Rinderpest, smallpox, Rinderpest is the only infectious disease that's been eradicated to date, right? And there were some tough countries, again, Pakistan, Ethiopia, these countries, but when people understood that there was a vaccine for Rinderpest, people would bring their animals to get vaccinated. And those same people would not bring their children to get vaccinated. And it's because animals are much more precious than children are in this environment, because if you don't have your animals, there won't be anything to eat for anybody. And children are replaceable. And those are the kind of value judgments that people who are in abject poverty have to make. I mean, it's a terrible choice that they have to make.
What do you see as the single most effective interventions in saving the lives of children in an environment like that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And this is a question that I have to wrestle with a lot, because I have, you know, I'm privileged to work in a situation where there's a lot of money, and I have to spend that money in the best way possible to save the most lives. We've made a goal that says that we want to eliminate diarrheal disease deaths by 2030, which currently it's 4 per 1,000 children or live births die of diarrhea, and so we want to make that less than 1 per 1,000 live births, and what's the best way to do that? We had a program at the foundation that was spending a lot of money on new drug development for diarrheal disease, which I thought didn't make sense because it takes very long to develop drugs, and by the time we would have one, 2030 would already be there. So I redid our strategy to say, okay, what can we do today to save lives? And are there products that if we use them at scale would save lives? And of course, diarrheal disease is completely preventable. Nobody should die of diarrheal disease, right? It's not, unlike pneumonia, where even in the US there are some deaths, but there are no diarrheal disease deaths. And in a country like Sri Lanka, which is a poor country, children don't die of diarrhea. I mean, so we have ORS, oral rehydration solution. So if everybody got ORS, there would not be death. So we changed our strategy to say, okay, we will work in our highest burden countries, in the highest, the lowest wealth quintile, where child mortality is highest, to make sure that ORS is a free commodity, which it isn't right now in many of the countries. In Ethiopia, for example, I was in Ethiopia, we went to many of the hospitals, and Ethiopia has a socialized health system. The ORS and amoxicillin for pneumonia was not available for free. Maternal newborn care was free, but not diarrhea and pneumonia. and when we went back up to the ministry and said, you know, that this is actually, there's a user charge for the beds, and people are having to pay for amoxicillin and ORS, they were surprised because it's supposed, the policy is that it should be free. But the hospitals are recovering money, and practices are not being monitored for pneumonia and diarrhea, but they are for maternal newborn, thanks to Gary, I think. So one is, getting back to your question, is, you know, what can we do now and scale up to make a difference? Another part is, I mean, I think vaccines are very powerful tools, and so for the most common infections, and thinking broadly for child health, what are the common infections for which a vaccine strategy is possible? And there are six: malaria, Shigella infections, which is something people might not have heard of, but work from the foundation shows that Shigella is like after rotavirus, in fact, almost bigger than rotavirus when you use sophisticated tools. Another type of diarrhea which causes you the bug when you go for travel and you get sick in India or Pakistan, that's ETEC, Group B strep, RSV, and typhoid. So we think like if you had vaccines against these six bugs, they would take care of a lot of the problems that would deaths. So we can have a vaccine strategy. We should try to reach the poorest of the poor with what exists today to make sure they get the best care. And then we have to think about all the other inputs that go into health for that poorest of the poor, and provide nutritional subsidies and things like that to make a difference in those situations.
What do you think are some of the biggest mistakes that NGOs, Westerners make when they walk into places like Pakistan and the places that you know well? What do you think that they don't get? What would you like to sit down and tell people? These are the things that you don't understand. These are the mistakes that you routinely make.
So I think what people don't understand is the difference between the, you know, the $2 to $10 people who earn $2 to $10 per day versus the less than $2 people. And so, for example, health system strengthening will not address the inequities that we see in the bottom of the pyramid population. And not understanding that those realities. And then also, I think in the NGO sector, there has been, we need to have more rigorous designs that show impact of the work that they do. I mean, it's something that I strongly believe in. It's controversial, but I believe
that.
Why
is it controversial?
Because showing impact is expensive. It takes money. So that project becomes more expensive if you are into metrics and indicators. But in the long run, I think that it's important to spend that money because otherwise you keep making the same mistakes. That's my view, but people believe that most of the money should be, it's a charitable purpose, so you spend it on the charity, providing food or et cetera, or whatever service you're providing, but not under, so there's a culture that's developed around projects, right? That you do this project and that project, and that measuring the impact of that project is not so important because it costs money. M&E is expensive, and sort of research is a bad word,
right? How has your view of the world changed since you joined Gates? How how has your view of global health issues and problems changed since you joined the Gates Foundation?
So I came in optimistic. I'm even more optimistic.
They're very optimistic people.
Right. Yes. I mean, it's one of the values of the foundation. Toughest things that I don't think that I have the answer is, you know, how much of what you do should be incremental versus transformational. And transformational is all high-risk stuff. The payout is potentially great, but the risk is also great. And so where should the foundation be in that space? And it's pulled in both directions. And I think I came in very conflicted on that. And my sort of personal view has now evolved to we have to do both, but innovation and innovation is extremely important, and we shouldn't put all our eggs in sort of the basket of today. It's very important to think about the future and think about what the world will be like in 15 years, how could we do stuff that really changes the world in 15 years. So how do you divide up that pie? I think I have a view of that now. It may not be the right view, but it's and sort of the way that I've thought about it is, you know, you do 20-30% in the world that can make a difference today, but the rest of it should be, and that's where the foundation can really make a difference.
Let's talk about you for a minute. When did you decide that, what was your childhood like?
So I was always very serious and worked very hard and wanted to please my mom. And so I remember this incident once that so I'm very type A. And
I can't believe that.
the once I didn't do so well in grade 4 or something, and my mother wouldn't sign my report. It was like the worst thing that could possibly have happened. Then, and so I mean, and always, yeah. So I mean, I just took work very seriously.
Why medicine?
Why medicine? Yeah, so I mean, I always was, not just medicine, but sort of biology always fascinated me. I mean, I remember even as a 14, 15-year-old, I was doing finding labs that I could work in. Although initially I thought that I would work on burn victims especially their infections. I was fascinated by bugs. I liked bugs. And so I thought burn victims get very high infection rates, and so that's what I wanted to do. But when I was in med school and I started working with kids, that just completely changed how I thought about what I could do.
Why? What was the impact that children had?
It's just that they children get better and they smile, and it's just you just fall in love with that whole experience. It's so impactful. So if you like results, like you should do pediatrics, right? Because they as soon as they get better, the choice was made at that time.
Since you're an optimist, what are you most optimistic about in increments of maybe the short term and the long term? Where do you see the greatest potential for change?
So I think women, girls getting educated will change the world, and more girls are getting educated. And we know that that's one of the strongest predictors of improved health outcomes, improving child outcomes. And even in Pakistan, I mean, 70% of girls are in school. 70%.
How dramatic has that risen over the past decade?
It's dramatic. I mean, it's gone up over the past decade. So, I mean, the past decade is in Pakistan is tough. But going back further in time, there's good progress. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we can do more. In fact, in Punjab, a lot more is happening than in Sindh. Sindh has been in an unfortunate situation where it's very dysfunctional. Sindh is a province of about 40 million people, where Karachi is, and it's just been in a dysfunctional government situation where there's a lack of governance, and so, and the impact of climate change and flooding has been huge, and so there are some actually indicators that it's worsened the child mortality situation. So Sindh is a separate case, but apart from Sindh, other places are looking better.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. One-to-One is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.